Well, this was Joe, W-H-2-L-Y-Y. He's a patient guy. He was sitting around all this time. W-H-2-L-Y-Y, K-2-I-W. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I guess you have to be over here, don't you?
Yeah, we have people that once they start asking questions, they ask more and more questions. They hug the time when that time comes up. We've got a few people like that, Joe. And the Romantinis were never like that. The B-H-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
No, neither were the Natals. This is a comment on a subject we were talking about last week. I think KC2-FYY brought this subject up. He's trying to test multiple bay, open bay antenna that's up to 470 megahertz. Now, one thing I want to understand first with these is if these are being fed with a phasing harness, each element that's being fed with a phasing harness has initially a higher impedance at the operating frequency than 50 ohms, correct?
That depends. It's complicated. Yes and no. Two or three things are going on here. There are methods by which you make the individual antennas far from 50 ohms, higher or lower, because of the way you've made the phasing harness. There's kinds of phasing harness that work well with other than 50 ohms. That's one possibility. Another kind of phasing harness really has 50 ohms on all of its output boards, and then each antenna is 50 ohms. However, depending how the individual antennas are working, if you've got a bunch of horizontal dipoles, or two horizontals and two dipoles east and west and two dipoles north and south, there is a mutual impedance phenomenon. The fact that the two dipoles are close to each other means that their impedance changes. You can take a dipole made out of the right materials, the right length, the right thicknesses, so that it represents 50 ohms when in free space. But two of those dipoles are half wavelength apart, and measure their impedance when they're fed simultaneously, they're now not 50 ohms anymore. Some of the signal flowing out of transmitter, out of dipole number one, goes into dipole number two, and vice versa, and changes the impedance. So the way you do impedance matching of a multi-element antenna with a phasing harness is complicated. Lots and lots of ways of doing it. I will admit that the amount of change in impedance because of the mutual effect is not major. Maybe the 50 ohms becomes 65 ohms, if you know what I mean. But, it's a little bit hard to jump to a conclusion as to what the phasing harness is doing. The best thing you can do is take the thing apart and study mechanically the phasing harness. What diameters of cable and what length of cable is between each of the elements of the phasing harness. You can eventually figure out what it is. That's the best way to figure out what's really going on. W-H-2-L-Y-Y, K-2-L-I-W.
Okay, very good. Well, the comment related to the subject last week, KC2-FYY, William, had a multiple bay antenna. I've seen these things before, heard of these things before. They're like made by Dental Products, I think. They have different dipole sections. You can actually rotate the dipole sections to have, some go east-west, some go north-south, to give you a semi-omni pattern, or if they all go the same way, you can get a cardioid pattern out of them. But anyway, the purpose of this discussion is pretty simple. He's trying to bring it down in frequency, and of course, the tubing is cut to a certain length, shaped a certain way, and you think what you got is what you got. Well, I played with some, not of those antennas, but simply have had beams that have been higher in frequency, and I brought the driven element down by going to Home Depot and getting a piece of 3/8-inch solid rod, about 4 foot long, 4 or 5 foot long, they sell these things. And like your copper tape thing, which is probably harder to find, I accomplished the same thing. If you cut the metal rod a little less in length than the driven element on the side, near side of the boom, and you attach it with hose clamps, it does two things. It lowers your resonant frequency, and it also gives you a little broader return loss across a specific frequency. So that type of operation, or that type of thing that Bill could do easily, and the material is very easy to MLB or any hardware store. Doing something like this on each section at a time might help them get this antenna down to 440 megahertz successfully, where you can use the thing and make something out of it. Back to you.
Yeah, by buying some of those rods and properly adjusting them, you've taken the Cadillac approach, Rich. You don't have to use copper tape. You can use aluminum tape. The kind of aluminum tape that's used for heating ductwork, air conditioning ductwork, that aluminum tape at the tip of an antenna will work well. Don't worry about the fact that the aluminum is not as good a conductor. The impedance at the tip of the antenna is so high that the capacitive coupling will still work. So you can still use the aluminum tape idea. And when you've got multiple elements, it's not too difficult to put the exact same amount of aluminum tape, one square inch of it, on the tips of each one of the antennas simultaneously. And even though you may have a little bit of difference in the tuning of one of the dipoles versus another one of the dipoles on this multi-element antenna, that difference in the amount of power that gets to the antenna is a very small difference. Even if the antenna presented a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, it only loses half a dB of the power that would have gone to it. So even though you could have an awful lot of mismatch between the individual antennas and still have nearly equal power out of all the antennas. Let me drop. So you're going to try to keep each of the antennas identical looking in the way you're putting on the aluminum tape. And once you arrive with the amount of aluminum tape on each of them, adjusting the size or making the aluminum tape a little longer than you have to, sticking the tab sticking out to one side, but you're bending it over with a long wooden stick while you're standing off to one side and watching the standing wave ratio. It isn't too difficult. It'll only take you 10 minutes to bring the antenna down to your desired frequency by putting aluminum tape on the tips of the dipole. And to worry about the difference between those dipoles is rather small. So it could have been done with aluminum tape. And once you find out that you can get a good impedance match with the aluminum tape, you can make it more substantial so it'll survive a 50-mile-an-hour wind by making a pair of aluminum tabs with a screw between the two tightened down at the end of the antenna. There are various ways you can make it, survive a 40-mile-an-hour wind, so to speak. So I would take that approach. You've taken the Cadillac approach. They both work. Yours is a lot more effort and it's going to take a lot more in time. My method of tuning with tape, I can get a tuning of that antenna down to your frequency. Even though it's got 4 or 8 elements to it, I can get it down to the right frequency in 5 or 10 minutes with copper tape. And copper tape on the end of a stick as a tuning wand, and you hold it near the tips of the antennas and near the base of the antennas. In one case, you're lengthening, in the other case, you're shortening. You can find out real quick which direction you want to go. It's a little bit like a blind man walking up a hill. The tilt of his feet tells him when he's going in the right direction. By watching your visuar as you put the tuning tool in various places, it'll tell you right away which way you want to go. Are your pieces of aluminum tape already too big or too small? W2LYY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
No, you may call it a Cadillac approach. I don't really think of it like that at all. Take, for example, going back to the original thing I said, on a beam, say a beam at 460 megahertz, the length of the top element, the driven element, might be, say, 5 inches on each side, up and down from the boom. All right? So if you make the aluminum rod about 4.5 inches, the mass of the rod, plus you can actually slide it up and down once you have it affixed with hose clamps, and actually tune it pretty easily, so it doesn't take you a long time at all. It takes you some finite amount of time to use a hacksaw to cut the rod initially. So if you want to count that into it, okay, maybe it could be considered a Cadillac method. But I think long term, it'll survive a very heavy windstorm once you put this thing together with, miniature hose clamps to tie it around to the regular part of the element. But this brings in something else I'm curious about, too. This is something you mentioned a long time ago. You said the spacing of the elements is not anywhere near as critical on a beam as is the length of the elements to get the whole antenna to resonate properly. If you do not have a grid dip meter, can you use a return loss bridge in any fashion, not attached to the antenna, but with a coil of wire on the output of the returnless bridge. Can you use that as a grid dip meter or something to simulate it to get an idea where those other elements are resident? Back to you.
Yeah, if you're starting off with, let me pick a number, a 475 megahertz Yagi antenna, and let me pick a number, it's got seven elements to it, and you want to bring it down from 475 megs to 445 megs. At first you would say, if I do all kinds of mechanical changes, and with tuning tools and tabs and shorting bars and whatever, on the driven element, I can force the driven element to be a good standing wave ratio in the middle of that 475 meg Yagi. I can make it a good impedance match at 445 megahertz. You've only done half the problem. The Yagi has a high-performance Yagi has a bunch of directors, the passive elements, the parasitic elements. Are they all tuned to 475 megs? Absolutely not. Each on a very high-performance Yagi, each of the directors, each of the parasitic elements are of a length that's tuned to individual frequencies. If you really study the highest performance long Yagi antennas, the Yagi has the length of the parasitic elements follows a little bit of a Coke bottle shape. And the ones way out at the tip are shorter. Some of the ones in the middle are shorter. Some of the others are longer. And so the high performance Yagi is a complicated structure. You can make the driven element give you a good impedance match at 445 megs. The Yagi gain is not going to be the same. The pattern is not going to be the same. But high-performance Yagi is a function of a well-impedance match dipole-driven element in the middle of that Yagi, but those individual directors on a high-performance Yagi are not all the same length. The old designs, people used to use equal spacing and equal length. That gave you a Yagi. It gave you a mediocre or low-performance Yagi. High-performance Yagi, each of those parasitic elements have their own individual length. I found that out with a very high-performance ratiometry antenna range. May 1976, I think it was, QST Magazine, article by K2RIW. I could resolve a 20th of a dB of improvement of gain on a Yagi in the real working environment. And as I started tuning individual elements for the correct length and the correct spacing, nothing was the same between all those elements when you tune it for the highest possible performance. High-performance Yagi design is very complicated. Some of the better impedance, some of the better modeling programs can handle that, but to move it to a new frequency is not as easy as you think. Now, it's not going to catch... Let me drop... It's not going to catch on fire and it's not going to explode if you don't get it right. But if the Yagi started off with 14 dB of gain because it had 15 elements, we'll say, at 475 megahertz, and now you tune it down to 445 megs with your tuning procedure, you're not going to have the same gain and the same pattern anymore. You could, if you change all the element lengths and all the element positions by the ratio of the frequency. The good news about the Yagi is that once you've got a good design on frequency A, you can make it work on frequency B if you change every one of the lengths and spacings by the inverse ratio of the frequency. If you're going up 10% higher in frequency and you make all the lengths and positions 10% shorter, you will have the same design. But and that's the best way of doing it. Know the percentage that you're moving it, change all the parasitic elements by that ratio, and maybe you can get away with not changing the spacings, just changing the length, because spacings are nowhere near as critical. And then do your tuning of the driven element. So by percentage of frequency shift, make that the percentage of shift of the parasitic elements. That's going to give you the best bang for the dollar, in my opinion, Joe. W12YY, K2RIW.
Yeah, I meant to use the word parasitic elements for the other elements. That's what I was talking about. The driven element, you can easily look at the return loss by looking at the input to the whole antenna versus frequency and see which way you're going, okay? That's easy to do. That's what I was talking about. In a case of an antenna that has welded elements to the boom, it's not so easy to take the elements off and re-weld them in a different spacing. That's a little bit of a tough job to do. So if you don't do that and you want to use it on a lower frequency, you'll have a compromise. But my question initially was about that. Can you use a return loss bridge as a grid dip meter in some fashion to know where those elements are tuned initially from the initial design? You might find like the first director might be tuned as 480, and maybe the second one is tuned for 475. The next one might be a different frequency other than that. I understand that the directors typically get a little less in length as you go out towards the front of the antenna, and the reflectors typically longer, like 105% of the driven element. But can a return loss bridge with a coil wire on the output be used as a grid dip meter to sort of give you an indication of where that antenna, the parasitic element, each one at a time, is being resonated? Back to you.
With the elements welded to the boom, which makes them very difficult to change in spacing, don't do it. I just did a mathematical experiment here. Assume the Yagi was originally on 475 megs. Assume you want it on 448 megs. The ratio of those frequencies are 1.06 to 1. That's a 6% change in frequency. Therefore, if you change the length of the elements by 6%, going down in frequency, you're going to make them 6% longer. Yeah, that's a little bit difficult to do. But you can do it with telescoping tubing on the end of the element. By changing the element length by 6%, leaving the spacing the same, because spacing is nowhere near as critical, you're going to get 95% of the performance you had of the original Yagi. And then make the driven element give you a good impedance match, and then you're there. That's the best way to change that Yagi to give very, very close to the original performance on the new frequency. Does that make some sense, Joe? From A2LYY, K2LIW?
Yes, it does make some sense, but you're not answering the question I asked you about using a return loss bridge as a grid dip meter. Can you do it or can't you do it?
Oh, I thought you knew that standing wave ratio is a complicated way of describing reflections ratio. If you've got a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, that really means something like 10%, I don't know the exact number, something like 10% of the power is reflected. So whether you look at reflected power or whether you look at standing wave ratio, there are two different ways of making the measurement as far as the end result you get. In both cases, you're really measuring percentage of reflected power. So can a high directivity directional coupler telling you what is the reflected power? A bird watt meter, looking at forward power and reverse power, and doing whatever you've got to do to the driven element so that the reverse power goes to zero, you're there. You've gotten a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. Whether you calculate standing wave ratio or reflected power or reflected voltage, that's your favorite way of doing it. The standing wave ratio is percentage of reflected power. That's the bottom line of what it really is, Joe. W2LYY, K2LIW.
I'm going to be stubborn about this because you're simply not answering my question. I understand about using it on the driven element, but if you don't own a grid dip meter, what do you do about the other elements? Simply go 6% more, or is there a way of actually calculating or looking at where they're resonant to begin with? Won't a grid dip meter show you that? If you had a grid dip meter in your hand and you went towards each element, director 1, director 2, director 3, wouldn't it show some sort of change in frequency of where the grid dip meter shows a dip? But if you don't own one, that's what I'm talking about. What else can you use in place of it?
As you often say, Joe, you're not listening. I told you to mechanically change the length of each of the elements by the percentage of the inverse of the frequency change. If you're changing the frequency by 6% and you're going lower in frequency, you're going to make the element 6% longer in length. It's a length phenomenon for the parasitic elements. I didn't tell you to measure their resonant frequency. The resonant frequency is all over the place, and you try to measure that with a grid dip meter or whatever. The individual parasitic elements, if each one of them was in free space, you could measure their resonant frequency. When it's in the middle of that Yagi and all those signals are bouncing around, there's no way you can electrically measure the individual parasitic elements and come up with a rational answer. It'll lead you into crazy results. Change the length by the percentage of the frequency change. I said that three times. I think you've now heard it. You're going to do it by physical length change, and then you're going to be 95% of the performance you had of the original Yagi. To B2LYY, K2LIW.
No, I did hear that three times. I did hear that. Okay? But it's a little... if you think about the process of what you're trying to do, it's a little tough to actually try to add the length simply to each element and make it stand, you know, make stay that way vertically. Or stand up, in an outside environment. The reason I thought of checking the tuning of those things, you say it's complicated. The reason I thought of checking it is because you use the same principle where you take a smaller piece of rod attached with a pair of hose clamps and slide that rod up a little bit, lengthening the element that way. I thought that's a more mechanically feasible way of doing it, and it'll last a lot longer. The only thing is, you can't look at the resonant length if you don't know what it was to begin with. That's what I was sort of getting at. You follow my thinking?
Even though the elements are welded to the boom, Joe, when you measure tip-to-tip length, that's what you're really changing, the tip-to-tip length. And when you want to extend the length, you could do it by a carefully selected piece of tubing that you slide on the end. Be careful now about using a hose clamp. The hose clamp is a lumpy object at the tip of the element that's adding a lot of tip capacitance. That hose clamp is a top hat capacitor. I don't recommend it. If you carefully choose a thin-walled piece of tubing that telescopes near the end of the element, that's going to give you a very good... and by the way, because the telescoping piece of very thin-walled tubing you put out there is a little bit larger in diameter, don't add... if you think you're going to add 6% to the length, make it 5% because what you're adding is a little bit larger in diameter, if you know what I mean. And believe it or not, do chamfer the sharp edge on the outer edge of that piece of added tubing. Don't leave the sharp edge there. Chamfer it, if you know what I mean. Get rid of the sharp edge. That's another crazy phenomenon you get with the tips of elements. So you're only making a 6% change. You can get away with murder by some of the techniques I'm describing. Be careful with the piece of tubing. With the hose clamp. That's a great big... if you put the hose clamp there all by itself without the telescoping tubing, that would be electrically lengthening those parasitic elements. W2LYY, K2LIW.
Okay, well, the purpose of this discussion was to try to help William out with his project of trying to get his antenna at lower frequency. And I think what I described would probably work for him. He may totally disagree. I just thought I'd throw it out there to give him something to think about. That's all. I mean, I've done it where I've just changed the driven element on a couple of beams, but I didn't change the rest of the elements. But they weren't like multi-element antennas, like maybe five, six element beams. So it wasn't something that had tremendously high gain to begin with. It was just to basically match my transmit a little better. But I do understand about the length has to be longer to make the beam follow suit and make it work better and have start approaching the same gain it originally had from where Rizzi was designed from. Okay, very good. Over to the next guy. Thanks for your time.
The comment on Yagi, send to Leo.
Yeah, stand by, Rich. I got to make a point before we forget it. If it's a 3 or 4 element short Yagi, Joe, that's nowhere near as critical as a 8 or 10 or 15 element Yagi. They start becoming very critical if you want high performance. A 3-element Yagi, 4-element Yagi, you can get away with murder. To move it 6%, just change the tuning of the driven element, and you're going to get 95% of the performance. And if you want to be a purist, try adding instead of 6%, 5% to the length of the two parasitic elements. But you're spitting in the ocean. A three-element Yagi, a four-element Yagi, you can get away with murder when tuning it to another frequency. You only care about the impedance match to the driven element. And you can look at that by a loss bridge, a directional coupler, a Berg watt meter. There's all a Viswar detecting device. As long as you make the impedance match to the driven element, you're 90% of the way there. And then whether or not on a three-element Yagi you change the length of the parasitic elements almost becomes academic. Is that making a little more sense, Joe? For B2LYY, T2LIW?
Yes, indeed, it does. Let me just say the last comment with, about the about doing this a couple times on a couple of beams I have, one three mounted on top of my on top of the house, a short beam for just, you know, UHF use. What I did notice was that on the original frequency of the beam being around 460, give or take, I had a certain return loss curve that was sort of symmetrical. All right, and when I added my pieces of aluminum tubing. A solid aluminum rod, and with the hose clamps, one hose clamp at the top, one hose clamp at the bottom, so they weren't, you know, as capacitive as you might think, but it just added the length a little bit. I think I made the thing maybe a quarter to 3/8 longer, and that seemed to bring the resonance down. But the funny thing was, it still had a moderately usable return loss from where it came from. Not too much. It went a little higher, maybe from 15, maybe went to like minus 10. But going in the negative direction, once I achieved my resonant point where it was much better, maybe down to almost minus 20, and if I went lower in frequency, it all of a sudden hit a point very quickly, would rise very, very sharply. So it was very unsymmetrical as far as the curve after I got done modifying it. That was something I didn't expect to have happen.
I can understand you didn't expect it. That's exactly what should happen. Your parasitic elements are tuned to a higher frequency. You've lowered the tuning of the driven element, and therefore the driven element, when you sweep it, it's going to drop off very fast on the low end because it's in a environment of parasitic elements that are tuned higher, and it's going to give you a more gentle Viswar curve on the high end, and it's going to drop off very fast on the low end. That's exactly what should happen, Joe. And if you then went the next step and extended the parasitic elements in length, don't change the spacing, extend their length by various techniques, you could make that more symmetric. When you make it more symmetric at the frequency in the middle of that crazy curve, that non-symmetric curve, where you're using it, is it going to make a big difference in gain? I doubt it. Half a dB or less difference. But if you want that curve to be symmetric because you're a purist, you can extend the length of the parasitic elements and the curve will become a bit more symmetric. However, high performance Yagis, long Yagis, with all the parasitic elements with the Coke bottle shape of length versus position on the boom, they almost always have a non-symmetric swept Viswar curve that almost always falls off faster on the low end. High-performance Yagis, when you sweep them, they fall off faster on the lower frequency end. Ain't that interesting, Joe? The B2LYY, T2LIW.
The stuff about antennas is always interesting. Okay, over to the next guy with the comment. Thanks, Dick. W2LYY.
Now, because you're in a good memory mode, I'll tell you why that occurs. Those parasitic elements constitute a slow wave structure. That's a fancy way of saying the signal that comes down, the planar signal from free space that's being coming into your Yagi. Some of that signal flows down the boom, some of it flows down a position in space far away from the boom. The signal flowing down the boom, going through those parasitic elements in the receive mode, traveled slower than the signal in free space. That's part of where the gain comes from. That makes the signal out there in free space start folding in to the driven element. You're making what looks like a double convex magnifier. You're making a magnifying glass. How can the Yagi, my 15 element, my 19 element Yagi on 432, has an effective capture area of a 5.5 diameter circle. Let me drop. If your eyes operated at 432 megahertz, you would think you're looking into a 5.5 foot diameter magnifying glass. That's the way it acts. Each of the parasitic elements are only in the vicinity of 12 inches long, 1 foot long. That antenna is gathering signals from a 5.5 foot diameter of space. That slow wave structure, the signal flowing down the boom, causes a signal to flow. It causes a phase shift because it's a slow wave structure, and the signal out there beyond the boom, out, you know, above and below, to the left, to the right, starts folding in toward the driven element. Very similar to what happens to a signal going through a magnifying glass as it focuses down to a focal point. The parasitic elements are acting like a magnifying glass with the focal point at the driven element. In order to do that, let me drop. A slow wave structure, each of the parasitic elements must act like a capacitor. They act like a capacitor if they're tuned shorter than the resonant length. You could say the parasitic elements are tuned to a higher frequency. That makes them act like the slow wave structure that gives you the high performance of the Yagi. Because they're tuned high to get the slow wave structure to act like a magnifying glass to focus at the driven element, that means when you sweep that driven element, you're going to see a non-symmetric Vizwar curve where it drops off fast on the low end and slow on the high end because all those parasitic elements are tuned high to act like a capacitor. Is that making a little more sense? The B2LYY, K2LAW.
Of course it makes sense. It makes always makes sense if you explain it. Thank you.
Now, you sound like a receptive audience that appreciates this kind of crazy information. When you've got a outdoor range, ratiometry antenna range, where with high reliability, you can resolve a 20th of a dB of gain increase or decrease, 0.05 dB. Every 0.05 dB of up or down, I could sense it on that ratiometry antenna range. Two antennas side by side going into a dual ratiometer. And I'm comparing the amount of signal of antenna A versus antenna B. They're both aimed at the source 100 feet away. And I'm tuning one of those antennas, and the other is the reference antenna. And because I'm measuring the difference between the two, I'm not measuring gain absolute. I'm measuring the difference in the gain between the two. I can resolve 0.05 dB of increase and decrease. I could carefully, with tuning tools, change the length and position of each individual parasitic element and peak for maximum gain, even though the standing wave ratio was changing, and then readjust the double stub tuner on the driven element to get the Vizwar back low again, if you know what I mean. When you're doing that kind of tuning, you make these crazy discoveries of where the gain is coming from. And it's how a Yagi really works is very different than all the theories you've read before. It is a synthesized slow wave structure acting like a magnifying glass. When you calculate the effective capture area that has to exist in order to have that amount of gain, let me drop. You come up with an effective capture area that's much, much bigger than what your eye sees when you look at this 12-inch long element along this boom on this 13-foot long thing called Yagi, 13-foot long boom, 12-inch element. Radio-wise, it's acting like a 5.5-foot diameter magnifying glass, focusing that signal onto the driven element. And to get the proper focus, each of those individual parasitic elements must have the right length, the right amount of slow wave structure. You can now plot something that's called velocity profile. In other words, the signal is slowing down as it goes down the boom. It is not going the same amount of slowness on each foot of the 13-foot boom. A different amount of slowness in different positions along that boom gives you the right focus of that magnifying glass. You want the whole magnifying glass to focus at the driven element. It's a complicated structure. Some of the really good computer modeling programs can handle this. Not all of them come up with the right answer along these lines. Okay, I know that Rich wanted to say something. N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, on Yagi antennas, the first an addendum to my forethought is made by a Metatron stab two. One for 120 volts, another model that I bought for 240 volts. The model number is an ICP-120 or an ICP-240.
Yagi, and they're both looking at the exact same chunk of soil, if you know what I mean, I get rid of the ambiguity created by ground reflection. You'd be amazed how many military antenna ranges now use the radiometry antenna range technique. Like, for instance, the Rome Air Development Center is now using that technique, and I think they got it from the QST article. So that's how it came about. It's how all these crazy techniques... And by the way, let me drop... When I took some of the Bill Orr Yagis that I had acquired way back in 1972, that somebody had sitting outdoor for a couple of years, I noticed that they all had a different standing wave ratio. Couldn't figure out what's going on. When I took my ohm meter and measured the amount of resistance between each parasitic element and the boom, each of the elements went through the boom. Because there are aluminum rods going through an aluminum boom, but out in the weather developing aluminum oxide, a certain percentage of those parasitic elements didn't make any contact to the aluminum boom anymore with the ohm meter, even though they physically went through the boom. So I know that an outdoor range, an outdoor antenna with the elements going through the boom, are breaking contact and changing the tuning. And the electrical length of those parasitic elements is very critical. By making sure they're mounted in an insulated structure, whether it be a plastic block sitting on top of the boom or with bushings going through the boom, as long as the parasitic element is insulated from the boom and now it can't build up aluminum oxide and break contact with the boom because it was tuned not in contact with the boom. So that's how the insulated elements came about, and now you don't have the problem of the elements breaking contact a year downrange. The Yagi slowly goes down in gain, but you don't know it because you keep getting used to it each day, and you don't have that effect when the elements are insulated from the boom. That's how all this came about. N2EO, K2LIW.
Very good, Dick. Where and how did you get those insulated machines, and who is RIW product? I hope you made money out of it, but we won't discuss that. Who is RIW Products? I know it was not you.
Yes, my good buddy who lived in Babylon at the time. And I'm not going to tell you his call letters, but a good buddy who is an extremely good mechanical engineer and machinist. And he found a company that made those crazy bushings. They weren't... Later on, somebody wasn't able to find that company, and they machined those bushings. There are other people who made those bushings by machining them with a lathe. But he found a company that made the shoulder bushings, or whatever, shoulder washers, whatever they're called, that were the right size. And where that company is now, and still does it still exist, I don't know. Over to you, Rich, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick. Am I correct in assuming you were the first one to use those shoulder bushings?
To my knowledge, the answer is yes. Now, there was a KLM Yagi on 1296, which had these T-shaped chunks of aluminum, T-shaped chunks of black plastic that sat on top of the boom, and the 1296 element sat on top of that T-shaped piece of black plastic. So, the KLM 1296 Yagi, one of the versions way back in the dark age, did insulate the parasitic elements from the boom. But when it comes to the elements going through the boom with insulated bushings, to my knowledge, I'm the first guy who did that. Over to you, Rich, and to EO, K2IW.
Well, that's very fine, Dick. My hat's off to you. The antenna worked very well. I had purchased one. I believe Barry, N2MB, purchased one also. I know the pattern was very good. It was a tight pattern, which meant high gain.
Yeah, when I think of it, I'll tell you the call letters and name of the guy who was my good buddy at the time. Because I haven't seen him in such a long period of time, I'm having trouble remembering his name or call letters. But he was an excellent mechanical engineer who... both worked at AIL at one time. That's how I first met him. A really smart guy. And then he worked for another company on Long Island that built amplifiers, microwave amplifiers. and he was the chief mechanical engineer, who was telling the electrical engineers what they should do to make things work right. Okay, the next person on the list, if he's still there after all this waiting, was Rich, WP2GXM. I hope we didn't put you to sleep with all this jazz, Rich. WP2GXM, K2RIW, go ahead.
K2RIW in the group, WP2GXM. No, it's actually a very lively night for a holiday weekend, so that's very good. Here's my question. I am still looking for an electronic TR switch that can handle 100 watts and still protect a modern solid-state receiver. And I've seen various diagrams and schematics, and I have the magic box from 4State, which can handle up to 10 or 20 watts. And I have a bunch of relay-driven TR switches. I am not interested in relays. I want fully electronic QSK-like operation between a separate transmitter and a receiver. I am very surprised that I haven't yet come across a commercial product built to do that. Does anyone know of a commercial, fully electronic TR switch that can do QSK for CW?
I do, Dick, and to wheel.
Yeah, stop. Hold on now, you guys. You got to be very careful here. If you're using any kind of a sensitive solid-state front end, like a low-noise preamplifier, and you want to be switching very rapidly between the transmit and receive mode and have the correct differential timing, by that I mean when you go from the receive mode to the transmit mode, you want to flip the relay, you want to first turn off the transmitter, and then 20 milliseconds later, so to speak, flip the relay. You cannot flip the relay while the transmitter is still transmitting, because while those contacts are mechanically moving, signal is jumping across that gap, and although you're running 100 watts on the transmitter, 10 watts is going to go through that gap, go roaring into the front end of your solid-state receiver or your low-noise preamplifier, and wipe out that first FET transistor. So you got to be very careful when it comes to a TR relay. You really want well-designed differential shifting such that the transmitter is killed first. Then you flip the relay into the receive mode. And when you go back to the transmit mode, you flip the relay first and then turn on the transmitter. So you want the transmitter to turn off first when you're going to the receive. You want the transmitter to turn on last when you go back to the transmit mode. Other than that, you're not protecting the low noise front end, because while that contact is moving, a signal is jumping across that gap. Does that make some sense to you, Rich? You'd be amazed how many people have wiped out the solid-state front end of their receiver because they tried to do a simultaneous shifting of a TR relay and didn't worry about protecting the receiver. WD2GXM, let's see if you made sense out of this first before we go beyond. K2LIW, go ahead, Rich.
I think it makes perfect sense. I've been researching this for a number of years. I'm familiar with the Phil Salis TR switch, which uses a relay. I've already got the Array Solutions QSK TR switch, which uses relays. I do not want mechanical relays. I am looking for a fully electronic, as in pin diodes, TR switch that can handle 100 watts from the transmitter and still protect the receiver in the fashion that you mentioned. I know about sequencing. I've seen a whole bunch of stuff about sequencing, but I don't see any commercial products which are fully electronic, no mechanical relays whatsoever. WP2GXM.
Okay, even though you're switching solid state, you're turning on and off pin diodes. And depending on whether or not it's a so-called constant impedance relay network or a non-constant impedance relay network, in either case, in the transition, as you're slowly going from the pin diodes being turned on and off for the transmit mode or turned on and off for the receive mode, in the transition, you still have power flowing through that relay in the wrong direction. Some of the transmit power does get a chance to flow into the receiver. You still need differential keying if you want full protection. And so let me think now. Can't think of the guy's call letters. There's a man who manufactures printed circuit boards where you can make a circuit, do all this for you with a differential keying. Oh yeah, gigahertz, W1 gigahertz. If you Google W1gigahertz.org or something like that, he's got the so-called microwave on the air, a microwave website logbook or whatever you want to call it, where a lot of this information is there. So W1 gigahertz has a number of articles. I'm now all of a sudden having trouble thinking of his name, but that goes, I thought of this frequently.
Wade.
That's him, Paul Wade. Paul Wade has got some articles describing how to do this. You still need differential keying, even with solid state, if you really want to protect your front end. There's a zillion guys out there who keep wiping out low noise front end preamplifiers or the front end of their receiver because of this phenomena without proper differential keying. Yes, I'm not sure there's a commercial product out there that does it, but the printed circuit boards that that Paul Wade shows you how to build, shows you the schematic of how to do it, and the Paul Wade, what is it called now? I think it's called the microwave handbook of the web handbook. He's got a name for it. I can't think of the name for it right now. But once you know his call letters and his name, Paul Wade and W1 gigahertz, you'll find his articles on the subject. There's a slim chance he mentions whether or not there is somebody making a commercial product that does all that. An awful lot of the guys who have done it successfully have done it homebrew. Over to you, Rich. WD2GXM, K2RIW.
Thank you, Dick. I will look up Paul Wade's article. I am super cautious about my receivers, as you mentioned. I am not about to go blowing out any part of my receivers, and a lot of them are vintage. I am certainly not going to go blowing out a vintage receiver. So I'm doing all this research ahead of time and making darn sure that the TR switch will protect my receiver and my receivers. And all right, I think the question is answered. I'm looking forward to Roy's stuff tonight, WB2GXM.
I have a comment, Dick, that may help.
Okay, unless you know of a commercial company that provides differential keying of a TR relay, don't tell me anything. Does the commercial company that you know of provide differential keying to protect the receiver? N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, I don't know. The only thing I do know, Rich Mencken mentioned vintage receiver. Does that mean a tube receiver? Because what I use, and what a friend used, with a Collins tube receiver, a Johnson TR switch bought use. There's another company that I copied it, and I had one. I don't remember the name of the company, but it uses two tubes. One a rectifier tube, and the other a tube that when you transmit, it cuts off the receiver. I don't believe it's sequenced, but it worked for me and my buddy with a tube receiver. Not a solid state, but Rich mentioned vintage. That's why I'm bringing it up.
Thank you, Rich. It's actually, I understand about the tube receivers, and I think I have a Johnson TR switch I hear someplace. I could use that with a tube receiver. I understand that most of the receivers that I want to protect are solid state, and they need to have that extra differential key. Thanks, Rich. WB2GXM.
Yeah, the nice thing about a tube is if you're only doing it for a millisecond or a microsecond, you can pour quite a bit of power into a tube receiver without damaging that tube. Solid state devices are nowhere near as friendly. You put more than a fraction of a watt into the front end of a solid-state receiver. If it's a real sensitive, low, super low-noise gas set, I don't think you can go beyond 50 milliwatts going into it without possibly doing damage to it. And that damage sometimes is very mysterious. The damage you do will take a half dB noise figure, low-noise preamp, gas set preamplifier, and make it jump up to 4 dB of noise figure, even though it's got almost the same amount of gain. You think it's working, but all of a sudden you got a high noise figure because you've done partial damage by putting power into it from this leakage of your TR relay. By the way, when we were discussing Yagis before, and who Rich was asking the question, who actually physically manufactured the RIW products? It was George Flanagan, W2KRM, Whiskey 2 Kilowatt Radio Mic. George Flanagan is the genius who came up with those mechanical arrangements for my method of making an insulated Yagi. Okay, we've gone way beyond the point. And by the way, with the holiday weekend, I was positive we've had very few people signing in. I'm kind of amazed with all the activity we've got here. We've eaten into some of your time here, Roy. But Roy has got an interesting puzzle tonight he's going to be giving you. AC2GR. You've got it, Roy. Dr. Roy, K2LIW. Wait a minute. Yes, GR. AC2GR, K2LIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Thank you, Dick. It's Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. As always, I want to remind everyone that if they have any topics, if they have questions, if they have anything to tell me, or to even tell you, or to tell Paul, if you want to just send it along to me, I'll make sure it goes to whoever needs to get it. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag at, my call sign, AlphaCharlie2GulfSierra.com. And there's already a web link on my page for this week from Paul, and the stories that I get to cover, I will post the links to them as well. And that's at roy.ac2gs.com. I do have a mailbag question. It came in the email only about an hour or so ago. The question is for you, Dick. Is the power grid from generation through transmission to connected load basically a resonant circuit at 60 hertz? Could you build a terminated non-resonant rhombic antenna and launch a 60 hertz RF wave with a connection to a wall plug and communicate via CW Morse? That's his question.
Yeah, the question that I think he's answering, Roy, and boy, my mind goes blank periodically. That's why I forgot your call letters. And there's a couple of guys with AC2G in their call letters. Sorry about that. The power supply from Con Ed, Loco, or whatever, at 60 hertz, giving you roughly 120 volts or 240 volts, is not resonant. There's one way of looking at it. Is not impedance matched. They do their darndest to make that circuit look like a micro-ohm impedance signal generator. Micro-ohm impedance. When it's a micro-ohm impedance signal generator, an ideal voltage generator, generating 120 volts, when you heavily load it by turning on your dryer and your electric range and your oven, your really heavy draw circuits in the house and your air conditioner, it likes 120 volts to only drop down to 119.9, you know, a tenth of a volt drop is what you'd like. And so therefore it's a tenth of an ohm impedance. So you don't impedance match. You do the opposite of impedance match. That's that crazy circuit. And therefore you've got nearly constant voltage as a function of low, open circuit or heavy load. Now, if you make an antenna of any kind, let me drop, rhombic, there's nothing magic about rhombic, although a great big square loop, let me drop. 60 hertz is an extremely low frequency, and we can calculate it, 300 million meters per second, speed of light, how big is it? For all I know, it's a 30-mile diameter loop will resonate at 60 hertz. You know, it's something really, really big. I don't think anybody is going to build an ordinary antenna of ordinary construction technique to operate at 60 hertz. There's various ways you can mechanically shrink the antenna. Big loading coils and helical winding and zigzagging and top hat capacitors. You use all the techniques for physically shrinking the antenna. Instead of the antenna being 50 miles in circumference, maybe you'd make it 3 miles in circumference. It's still going to be much too big. And when you did launch a 60 hertz signal, would it really transmit the way you wanted to, reflecting off the ionosphere? Yes, it would. Could you transmit a signal between New York and London? Yes. And the signal that arrived at London would be a fraction of a microvolt, even though you're putting kilowatts of signal into that signal.